Welcome back to the Hour of the Time. I'm William Cooper. Before we get into the continuation of Mind Control in America, ladies and gentlemen, I want to tell you a little bit about our new organization, the Intelligence Service. It used to be known as CAGI, the Citizens Agency for Joint Intelligence, is now the Intelligence Service. You see, a long time ago, I realized, when I began to understand as a member of the Office of Naval Intelligence, that all was not as it should be. The public was living in fantasy land, and I had been living in fantasy land most of my life, had no idea what the reality of the world really was until I was exposed to it when I was inadvertently thrust into the intelligence arena. And I realized at that moment that information, ladies and gentlemen, not money, is power. And specifically, information, not money, is the power of the 90s. Now, I've been trying for several years to make an avenue of information available to the people. And now that we must form the militia again to the militia, which is, as a matter of fact, the whole of the people. The mission of the intelligence service is to guarantee the security of a free state. We will provide for the gathering, analysis, and distribution of intelligence for the whole of the people, the militia. We will help the people to form a legal and lawful militia in every state to execute, if required, the laws of the Union, suppress insurrection, repel invasion, and protect and defend the Constitution of the United States of America against all enemies, foreign or domestic. The method that we will use to do this, ladies and gentlemen, is to identify and recruit a nucleus of leaders who will accomplish the following. Number one, establish a network of covert agents to collect raw intelligence from all sources. Two, forward that intelligence to the St. John's Research Center for analysis and distribution, and should have anything happen to this center, we will provide a secondary point to forward the information. Number three, maintain the research center as a library and records repository for the use of the members and the whole of the people, the militia. Now, I put this together at great cost. It's a very large building. I have collected over my life one of the best libraries in the nation, maybe the world, on specific subjects relative to what has happened in the world to bring us to this point today. Anyone can come in here and use our facilities. We will have an area where you may view videotapes from our extensive video library. Listen to audio tapes from our extensive audio library. And I'm not talking about tapes of the Hour of the Time, folks. I'm talking about tapes you never dreamed of. We will have television studios here. And, of course, we have the radio studios of the Hour of the Time. We will be holding classes and seminars and conventions all over the United States from time to time. And yes, sooner or later, we will come to your area. Four, maintain radio studios for the worldwide satellite and shortwave broadcast of the Hour of the Time. Five, utilize the CAGI News Service for the publication of books such as Behold a Pale Horse and others, and a newspaper such as The Intelligence Analyst. Six, build and maintain television studios for the eventual production of a television series also named The Hour of the Time. And if those who have promised the help that they have promised us carry out their promise, we will be on television, ladies and gentlemen, all over the country on cable. 7, conduct seminars, conventions, and training sessions for those who need help in developing the skills needed to perform their assigned tasks in a more competent manner. And I'm specifically talking about members of the intelligence service. 8, provide for the production of audio tapes, videotapes, books, and materials for the education of the general public. 9, provide information on weapons handling, marksmanship, and the true purpose of the second article in amendment to the Constitution. 10, provide information and materials for survival training and skills. Provide for low-cost survival equipment and long-term food storage items. 11, provide for the education of politicians, judges, city and state officials, sheriffs, police officers, military personnel, and anyone else who may be innocently helping to destroy the United States of America and create a one-world government under the United Nations. 12, to encourage people like you, ladies and gentlemen, to become active, to help us create a safe, secure, and promising future for ourselves, our children, and our posterity, and to help us to resist the movement toward worldwide totalitarian socialism. Now, if that sounds like something that you're interested, if you would like to join, if you would like to join us in the fight to save our liberty, folks, just follow these very simple instructions. Send a check or money order made out to Annie, A-N-N-I-E. In fact, anything you ever send to us in the way of a negotiable instrument, make it out to Annie, A-N-N-I-E. Now, don't call and say Annie who or Annie what or did he say Annie? Yes, I did, and it's just Annie, period. Send check or money order for $100 for a single membership, are $150 for a family membership. Now, when we say family membership, folks, we mean the adults in the family, 18 years or over. Anything that we conduct, if you have a family membership, your children are welcome and they won't be charged for attendance. But the adults, as members, will be charged, but according to the membership. Upon receipt of your membership fee, we will then forward the Oath of Allegiance, which must be administered and notarized by a notary public. If you cannot take the oath, you cannot be a member. And I'll read you that oath in just a few moments. If you decide not to take the oath for any reason, return all materials. That means everything that we sent to you, no matter how insignificant it may seem to you, return those materials to us immediately, and we will send you a full return by first-class mail, immediately upon receipt. Now, if you decide to take the oath and you become a member, you'll receive a large, very large, beautiful certificate of membership, an ID card identifying you as an agent of the intelligence service. You'll have a subscription to the intelligence analyst and an opportunity to receive a fully accredited press pass that will get you into places you never dreamed you would ever go. If you don't believe that, ask CADU members who have had press passes. They'll tell you some tales. In addition, folks, you'll be assigned to the intelligence service station chief in your area for assignments. Now, remember, this isn't too much different from CADGY, but there are some differences, and it's a lot better, let me put it that way. But you'll be assigned to the intelligence service station chief in your area for assignments. You'll be given a rank equivalent to the highest military rank you held if you were in the military, or a rank equal to your ability to perform as an intelligence operative. All members will be eligible for promotion based upon merit. Senior agents already in service, folks, have been appointed as station chiefs. Others will be promoted as the need arises. Why will we have military rank? Very simply, ladies and gentlemen, we are the intelligence arm of the militia. We can't get around it. It must be that way. Intelligence service members also receive very steep discounts, as most of you have discovered on the air here. You've ended up spending a lot of money because you weren't members. Those who are members have saved sometimes thousands of dollars. Intelligence service members receive steep discounts on seminars, conventions, books, audio tapes, videotapes, food packed especially for long-term storage, survival and militia equipment, and much, much more than we can tell you here in just these few minutes. In fact, just one purchase could make up for your entire membership fee. Most of you know that. Some of you new listeners may not. Now I'm going to read you the oath so that you'll know exactly what it is and that there's no hidden agenda here. This is the oath of the intelligence service. And I quote, "I do affirm with free will and full knowledge that I will carry out to the best of my ability all legal and lawful instructions of the officers of the intelligence service, and that I will gather by any and all legal and lawful means information from all sources. I will provide for the free flow of information to the militia of the several states of the Union. If required, I will protect and defend the Constitution of my state, execute the laws of the Union, suppress insurrection, and repel invasion. I will protect and defend the Constitution of the United States of America from all enemies, foreign or domestic. For the support of this oath, with a firm reliance on the protection of divine providence, I pledge my life, my fortune, and my sacred honor." End quote. Now, for those of you who've been asking, let me give you just a little information about the convention coming up August 1st through the 5th, the first week of August. We are having a convention here in St. John's, Arizona. In fact, it's the first in a series of seminars and conventions to be conducted in many locations throughout the nation. The main goal, ladies and gentlemen, is to train our agents and our journalists in the fine art of gathering raw intelligence. At this convention, you will become acquainted with the research library, records repository, the radio and television studios of the hour of the time, the use of computers to gather and disseminate information, survival and weapons skills, and information from several surprise guest speakers whom we will not reveal until the convention begins. A day will be spent on the range with various weapons and with the long-range rifle. CAGI and intelligence service members, folks, will have a much needed opportunity to meet, communicate, and get to know each other, and this is something that they have wanted to do for a long, long time. In fact, I'll bet you anything that lifelong friendships will blossom during the long evening conversations that I foresee. In fact, you may find yourself sitting around a campfire under the clear, star-studded Arizona sky. And if you've never seen the Arizona sky, you are in for a great treat. I guarantee, folks, it's going to be an experience you will treasure for the rest of your life. The hour of the time, live every night, 5 full days and nights of fun and education with active people who think just like you. Prices and registration fees include all speakers, events, fees, and materials directly related to scheduled conference activities. Prices do not include transportation, meals, or lodging. We recommend that you bring a sleeping bag and some warm clothing and some insect repellent for the camp out, as we are the lowest elevation is 5,600 feet and goes all the way up to over 9,000 feet. And it's sometimes very cool at night. So, CAGI or intelligence service members, $100 per person. Intelligence service members with a family membership are $150 per family. Non-members, I don't care who you are, $250 per person. In the past, folks, the Soviet Union has invested large sums of time and money investigating microwaves. In 1952, while the Cold War was showing no signs of thawing, there was a secret meeting at the Sandia Corporation in New Mexico between United States and Soviet scientists involving the exchange of information regarding the biological hazards and safety levels of electromagnetic radiation. The Soviets possessed the greater preponderance of information, and the American scientists were unwilling to take it seriously, so they say. In subsequent meetings, the Soviet scientists continued to stress the seriousness of the risks, while American scientists downplayed their importance. But shortly after the last Sandia meeting, the Soviets began directing a microwave beam at the United States Embassy in Moscow, using embassy workers as guinea pigs for low-level electromagnetic radiation. Washington, D.C., folks, was very oddly quiescent regarding the Moscow embassy bombardment. Discovered in 1962, the Moscow signal was investigated by the Central Intelligence Agency, which hired a consultant, Milton Zarek, and codenamed the research project Pandora. According to Zarek, the Moscow signal was composed of several frequencies and was focused precisely upon the ambassador's office. The intensity of the bombardment was not made public, but when the State Department finally admitted the existence of the signal, it announced that it was fairly low. There was a consensus among Soviet electromagnetic radiation researchers that a beam such as the Moscow signal was destined to produce blurred vision and loss of mental concentration. The Boston Globe reported that the American ambassador had not only developed a leukemia, blood disease. Let me read that again for you. The Boston Globe reported that the American ambassador had not only developed a leukemia-like blood disease, but also suffered from bleeding eyes and chronic headaches. Under the CIA's Project Pandora, monkeys were brought into the embassy and exposed to the Moscow signal. They were found to have developed blood compensation anomalies and unusual chromosome counts. Embassy personnel were found to have a 40% higher than average white blood cell count. Now, a high white blood cell count, folks, usually is an indication of infection. While Operation Pandora's data gathering proceeded, embassy personnel continued working in the facility and were not informed of the bombardment until 10 years later. Embassy employees were eventually granted a 20% hardship allowance for their service in an unhelpful post. Throughout the period of bombardment, the Central Intelligence Agency used the opportunity to gather data on psychological and biological effects of the beam on American personnel. The United States government began to examine the effects of the Moscow signal, and the job was turned over to the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, known as DARPA. DARPA was developing electromagnetic weaponry. We have reason to believe that they've been working with electromagnetic propulsion and weaponry ever since the end of World War II. The man in charge of the DARPA program, Dr. Jack Verona, is so important, folks, and so secretive that he doesn't even return the president's telephone calls. If you can imagine somebody who has that kind of power. The American public was never informed. They're never informed anyway. They were never informed that the military had planned to develop electromagnetic weapons until around 1982, when the revelation appeared in a technical Air Force magazine. The magazine article stated, and I quote, "Specifically generated radio frequency radiation, or RFR fields, may pose powerful and revolutionary anti-personnel military trends," end quote. The article, folks, indicated that it would be very easy to use electromagnetic fields to disrupt the human brain because the brain itself was an electrically mediated organ. It further indicated that a rapidly scanning RFR system would have a stunning or killing capability over a large area. The system was developable. Navy Captain Dr. Paul E. Taylor read a paper at the Air University Center for Aerospace Doctrine, Research, and Education at Maxwell Air Force Base, Alabama. Dr. Taylor was responsible for the Navy's radiation laboratory and had been studying radiation effects on humans. In his paper, Dr. Taylor stated, "The ability of individuals to function as soldiers could be degraded to such a point that would be combat ineffective. The system, folks, was so sophisticated that it employed microwaves and millimeter waves and was transportable by a large truck." Now, there's a place in California, just a little north and east of San Francisco, called Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory. It's in the South Bay area, and they've been working on the development of a brain bomb. A bomb could be dropped in the middle of a battlefield, which would produce microwaves, incapacitating the minds of soldiers within a circumscribed area. Applications of microwave technology and espionage were available for over 25 years. In a meeting in Berkeley, California, of the American Association for the Advancement of Science, as early as 1965, Professor J. Anthony Dusch of New York University provided an important segment of research in the field of memory control. Now, in layman's terms, so that you'll understand this, Professor Dusch indicated that the mind is a transmitter, and if too much information is received, like too many vehicles on a crowded freeway, the brain ceases to transmit. The professor indicated that an excess of acetylcholine in the brain can interfere with the memory process and control. He indicated excess amounts of acetylcholine can be artificially produced through both the administration of drugs or, get this, the use of radio waves. The process, and I've told you this before, you didn't believe me, but it's true. The process is called EDOM, or EDOM, electronic dissolution of memory. Remember, I told you on previous episodes of The Hour of the Time that there is a technology available to the intelligence community that can enable them to erase whole segments of the memory of a targeted person from quite a distance, in fact, and implant in the place where this memory used to exist, it's now gone, a new memory that in fact never happened in reality. But when the subject remembers, it will be as if this had really happened in their life. The memory transmission can be stopped, folks, for as long as the radio signal continues. As a result, the awareness of the person skips over those minutes during which he is subjected to the radio signal. Memory is distorted and time orientation is destroyed. Now, does that bring anything to mind? Those of you who are buying into this alien abduction bullshit? That's exactly what it is. Most of the people involved are agents of the Central Intelligence Agency. The most prominent is Bud Hopkins. According to Lincoln Lawrence, author of Were We Controlled, EDOM is now operational. Quote, "There is already in use a small EDOM generator transmitter which can be concealed on the body of the person. Contact with this person, a casual handshake, or even just a touch transmits a tiny electronic charge plus an ultrasonic signal tone which for a short period which will disturb the time orientation of the person affected. It can be a potent weapon for hopelessly confusing evidence in the investigation of a crime. End quote. 30 years ago, folks, Alan Frey discovered that microwaves of 300 to 3,000 megahertz could be heard by people even if they were deaf, if pulsed at a certain rate, appearing to be originating just in back of the head. The sound boomed, clicked, hissed, or buzzed, depending upon the frequency. Now, this is a common occurrence reported by people who say that they had close encounters with extraterrestrial beings, that this buzzing in their head. Later research has shown that the perception of the waves take place just in front of the ears. The microwaves cause pressure waves in the brain tissue, and this phenomenon vibrates the sound receptors in the inner ear through the bone structure. Some microwaves are capable of directly stimulating the nerve cells of the auditory pathways. This has been confirmed with experiments with rats in which the sound registers 120 decibels, which is equal to the volume of a nearby jet during takeoff. Now, folks, aside from having the capability of causing pain and preventing auditory communication, a much more subtle effect was demonstrated at the Walter Reed Army Institute of Research by Dr. Joseph C. Sharp. Dr. Sharp himself was the subject of an experiment in which pulsed microwave audiograms are the microwave analog of the sound vibrations of spoken words were delivered to his brain in such a way that he was able to understand the words that were spoken. Military and undercover uses of such a device might include driving a subject crazy with inner voices in order to discredit him, or conveying undetectable instructions to a programmed assassin, making people believe that God is speaking to them, or that they are receiving channeled instruction from ascended masters, or from the spirit world, or from God or Jesus Christ himself. Get the picture? But the technology, folks, has been carried even a step further. It's been demonstrated by Dr. Ross Adey that microwaves can be used to directly bring about changes in the electrical patterns of different parts of the brain. His experiments showed that he could achieve the same mind control over animals as Dr. Delgado did in the bull incident. Now, Dr. Delgado used brain implants in his animals. Dr. Adey used microwave devices. Without preconditioning, he made animals act and look like electronic toys, carrying out his bidding on his command. No brain implantation. Now, let's go back into history a little bit. Let's go back, folks, to the conclusion of World War II. I think you'll find what you're going to learn here very illuminating, shall we say. But before we get to that, let's take a short break. Don't go away. As usual, I'll be right back. only the best music on the hour of the time, all of it designed to deliver a message, even the classical selections that we play. If you research the name of these selections, or what piece it appeared in, or what opera it was a part of, or if you can understand Italian, in the case of some of the things, and listen to the lyrics, then you know. And of course, if you understand English, you know that everything we play in English has a message. Everything we play has a message. The hour of the time is an instrument to deliver a message of magnificence, of warning, of preparation for the future, of what mankind could be rather than what he is, what we are always that most of us fail to recognize that keeps us from living up to our full potential. And of course, there are always those who believe that they have to manipulate everyone else in order to bring about the world that they feel is best for everybody. I am a messenger. You may not like me, or you may not like the content of my message, but you had better not ignore it, ladies and gentlemen. You will see in the future how serious this is. Now, part of the message of this program is you need to prepare for the future. We are on the brink of a total breakdown of all levels of society in this country. And I'm telling you right now, things have not changed. Things are not going to change. They're going to get worse, as you can see every single day. We are headed for a lot of bloodshed, unfortunately. It's always been the aim of the hour of the time to prevent that, but I see no way that any prevention is going to occur at this late state of the game. And it is a game being fought out by two terribly powerful forces. The forces of good and the forces of evil. One of the ways that you must prepare, ladies and gentlemen, is economically. We can never get away from the fact that we are human beings and that we need certain things to survive, and that no one in their right mind in a state of complete societal breakdown is going to give you anything that they have, because by doing so, it will decrease their chances of survival. Now, there may be some people who have enough to be able to do that, but most people don't and won't. In fact, most people won't have near what they need for themselves, much less be able to take care of those of you who are too lazy, too stupid, too ignorant, or just plain like to procrastinate instead of prepare. Those of you who think that at the last minute you're going to be able to take care of everything, you're wrong. Now, to prepare financially, I urge you to call our sponsor, Swiss America Trading. Ask them what they can do to help you prepare for what is coming. And if you decide not to deal with them, call somebody else. Find somebody that you can deal with, although I do not believe, because I've tried it, that you'll find anyone better or more honest or more upfront or more capable than Swiss America Trading. So call them now, 1-800-289-2646. That's 1-800-289-2646. You know, folks, I don't tag my name to anything unless I really have checked it out and know that it's a good thing. So do it now. You'll be glad that you did. A great weight will be lifted from your shoulders. 1-800-289-2646. That's 1-800-289-2646. You'll be glad that you did. Thank you. At the conclusion of World War II, ladies and gentlemen, American investigators learned that Nazi doctors at the concentration camps in Germany had been conducting mind control experiments on inmates. They experimented with hypnosis and with the drug mescaline and several others. Now, mescaline is a quasi-synthetic extract of the peyote cactus. It is very similar to LSD in the hallucinations which it produces. Though they did not achieve the degree of success they had desired, the SS interrogators, in conjunction with the doctors, were able to extract the most intimate secrets from the prisoners when the inmates were given very high doses of mescaline. There were fatal mind control experiments conducted at Auschwitz. The experiments there were described by one informant as brainwashing with chemicals. The informant said the Gestapo wasn't satisfied with extracting information by torture. So the next question was, why don't we do it like the Russians, who have been able to get confessions of guilt at their show trials? They tried various barbiturates and morphine derivatives, and after prisoners were fed a coffee-like substance, two of them died in the night and others died later. The mescaline experiments were written up in a lengthy report issued by the United States Naval Technical Mission, whose job it was at the conclusion of the war to scour all of Europe for every shred of industrial and scientific material that had been produced by the Third Reich. It was, folks, as a result of this report that the United States Navy became interested in mescaline as an interrogation tool. If you think the Nazis were bad, believe me, our intelligence community is just as bad or worse. The Navy initiated Project Chatter in 1947, the same year the Central Intelligence Agency was formed. The Chatter format included developing methods for acquiring information from people against their will, but without inflicting harm or pain. At the conclusion of the war, the OSS was designated as the investigative unit for the International Military Tribunal, which was to become known as the Nuremberg Trials. The purpose of Nuremberg was to try the principal Nazi leaders. Some Nazis were on trial for their experiments, and the United States was using its own truth drugs on these principal Nazi prisoners in our own experiments against namely Göring, Ribbentrop, Speer, and eight others. So you see, we were trying them and extracting the information to convict them using the same crimes that they were being tried for. The justice in charge of the tribunal had given the OSS permission to use the drugs that he was getting ready to condemn the prisoners for using. The Dachau doctors who performed the mescaline experiments also were involved in aviation medicine. The aviation experiments at Dachau fascinated Heinrich Himmler. Himmler followed the progress of the tests, studied the findings, and often suggested improvements. The Germans, you see, had a keen interest in several medical problems in the field of flying. They were interested in preventing pilots from slowly becoming unconscious as a result of breathing the thin air of the high altitudes, and there was interest in enhancing night vision, and we had the same interests ourselves. The main research in this area, folks, was at the Institute of Aviation in Munich, which had excellent laboratories. The experiments in relationship to the Institute were conducted at Dachau. Inmates had been immersed in tubs of ice water with instruments placed in their orifices in order to monitor their painful deaths. Dr. Hubertus Strughold, who ran the German aviation medicine team, confirmed that he had heard humans were used for the Dachau experiments. Hidden in a cave in Heilin were files recording the Dachau experiments, which were recovered after the war. On May 15th, folks, 1941, Dr. Sigmund Rascher wrote a letter to Himmler requesting permission to use the Dachau inmates for experiments on the physiology of high altitudes. Rascher lamented the fact that no such experiments have been done using human subjects, and he said this, and I quote,
The experiments are very dangerous, and we cannot attract volunteers, end quote. He told this to Himmler, and his request was approved. Dachau was filled with communists and social democrats, Jews, Jehovah's Witnesses, gypsies, clergymen, homosexuals, Poles, and people just plain critical of the Nazi government. Upon entering Dachau, prisoners lost all legal status. Their hair was shaved off, all their possessions confiscated, they were poorly fed, and they were used as slaves for both the corporations and the government. It was a labor camp. The SS guards, as most people placed in positions as God above other people, were brutal and sadistic. The idea to test subjects at Dachau was really the brainchild of Erich Hipke, chief surgeon of the Luftwaffe. Between March and August of 1942, extensive experiments were conducted at Dachau regarding the limits of human endurance at high altitudes. These experiments were conducted for the benefit of the German Air Force. These experiments took place in a low-pressure chamber in which altitudes of up to 68,000 feet could be simulated. The subjects were placed in the chamber and the altitude was raised. Many inmates died as a result. The survivors, folks, often suffered serious injury. One witness at the Nuremberg trials, Anton Pascheleg, who was sent to Dachau in 1942, gave an eyewitness account of the typical pressure test. And he said this, and I quote, "The Luftwaffe delivered a cabinet constructed of wood and metal. It was possible in the cabinet to either decrease or increase the air pressure. You could observe through a little window the reaction of the subject inside the chamber. The purpose of these experiments was to test human energy and the subject's capacity to take large amounts of pure oxygen and then to test his reaction to a gradual decrease in oxygen. I have personally seen through the observation window of the chamber when a prisoner inside would stand a vacuum until his lungs ruptured. Some experiments, folks, gave men such pressure in their heads that they would go mad and pull out their hair in an effort to relieve the pressure." They're talking about the same thing that happens to a diver when he decompresses too fast. These people in this pressure chamber actually were given the bins. They would tear their heads and face with their fingers and nails in an attempt to maim themselves in their madness. They would beat the walls with their hands and head and scream in an effort to relieve pressure in their eardrums. These cases of extreme vacuums generally ended in the death of the subjects. The former prisoner also testified, quote, "An extreme experiment was so certain to result in death that in many instances the chamber was used for routine execution purposes rather than an experiment," end quote. Now that statement is doubtful. It has no corroborating evidence, and doctors generally did not engage in executions. A minimum 200 prisoners were known to have died in these experiments total during the entire war, ladies and gentlemen. The doctors directly involved with the research held very high positions. Karl Brandt was Hitler's personal doctor. Oskar Schroeder was the chief of the medical services of the Luftwaffe. Karl Gebhardt was chief surgeon on the staff of the Reich Physician SS and police and German Red Cross president. Joachim Murgowski was chief of the Hygienic Institute of the Waffen SS. Helmut Poppendick was a senior colonel in the SS and chief of the personal staff of the Reich Physicians SS and police. Siegfried Ruff was the director of the Department of Aviation Medicine. So if you think because a doctor took the Hippocratic Oath and he has pledged his life to help those in pain and suffering, if you think that these people will not perform experiments that will result in the death of the subject, you are wrong. Now, we've concentrated here on German experimentation in World War II because it's well known. And we've also talked to you and given you proof, reference to experimentation done in the United States and Canada. on human guinea pigs that resulted in death conducted by doctors, psychiatrists, and psychologists. These people will do what they're told. The first guinea pig, human guinea pig, in these experiments in Germany, was a 37-year-old in good health. Himmler invited 40 top Luftwaffe officers to view a movie of an inmate dying in the pressure chamber. After the pressure chamber tests, the cold treatment experiments began. They consisted of immersing inmates in freezing water while their vital signs were monitored. The goal, folks, was to discover the cause of death. Heart failure was the answer. An inmate described the procedures. Quote, "The basins were filled with water and ice and was added until the water measured 37.4 degrees Fahrenheit and the experimental subjects were either dressed in a flying suit or were placed in the water naked. The temperature was measured rectally and through the stomach. The lowering of the body temperature to 32 degrees was terrible for experimental subjects. At 32 degrees, the subject lost consciousness. They were frozen to 25 degrees. The worst experiment was performed on two Russian officer POWs. They were placed in the basin naked. Hour after hour passed, and while usually after a short time, just 60 minutes, freezing had set in, these two Russians were still conscious after 2 hours. After the third hour, one Russian reportedly told the other, 'Comrade, tell that officer to shoot us.' The other replied, 'Don't expect any mercy from this fascist dog.' Then they shook hands and said goodbye. The experiment lasted at least 5 hours until death occurred. Of course, they lost consciousness long before that. Now, should you think this so terrible, the United States Air Force conducted exactly the same experiments after the war using American servicemen volunteers. If any of them died, it's been well hidden. Usually they took them out of the water when the vital signs demonstrated that they were approaching the point of no return. Dry freezing experiments were also carried out at Dachau. One subject was put outdoors in a stretcher at night when it was extremely cold. While covered with a linen sheet, a bucket of cold water was poured over him every hour. He was kept outdoors under sub-freezing conditions. In subsequent experiments, subjects were simply left outside naked in a court under freezing conditions for hours. Remember, these were experiments designed to find out what the human body could withstand under various conditions. They resulted in pain, suffering, torture, whatever you want to call it. Himmler gave permission to move the experiments to Auschwitz because it was more private and because the subjects of the experiment could howl all night if they wanted to. No one really gave a damn. The physical pain of freezing was and is terrible. The subjects died by inches. Heartbeat became totally irregular. Breathing difficulties and lung edema resulted. Hands and feet became frozen white. As the Germans began to lose the war, the aviation doctors began to keep their names from appearing in Himmler's files for fear of future recriminations, and they found other experiments to involve themselves in which were not so incriminating. Now, tomorrow night we'll continue, and we're going to talk about Project Paperclip. We're going to talk about some things that Americans would rather not talk about. But as usual, on the hour of the time, you will hear the truth whether you want to or not. Now, for those of you who are interested in applying for membership in the intelligence service or interested in attending the convention in the first week of August, the 1st through the 5th, you can write to us for information and do it soon. Registrations are coming in. And this is a big place, but we can only take so many people. The address, folks, is Post Office Box 1420. That's 1420. Sholow, spelled S-H-O-W. LOW, Arizona, 85901. That's P.O. Box 1420, Shiloh, Arizona, 85901. Now, if you'd like to call the number here at the Research Center and the library, and by the way, books are going up on the shelves. One whole bank of shelves is full of books now. The titles would make your mouth drool. The number is 602, area code 602-337-2562. That's 602-337-2562. The fax, should you desire to send us a fax, is area code 602-337-2524. That's 602-337-2524. The Computer BBS, folks, is online. We're ironing out all the bugs. It seems to be working pretty good now. Now, most of the BBS is for members only. However, we have three sections where the public can leave messages and download files or upload files. We have a public area where all topics are allowed for discussion. We have a market conference where you can leave postings for things you have for sale or advertisements of whatever kind. Make sure they're in good taste, though, or we'll delete them. And also a Hour of the Time conference where you can talk about this program. And if any of you out there are transcribing the Hour of the Time, we would like for you to post those transcriptions in that conference so that other people can download transcripts of the Hour of the Time and study them or use them or pass them around or whatever they want to do. If you are transcribing the Hour of the Time, folks, make sure that you transcribe it literally. Don't try to interpret what I say. Don't insert comments. Don't do anything. Don't mess with this program. If you want to transcribe it honestly and correctly. And let the world judge the information. Good night, folks. Sleep well. God bless you all.